I want to thank Jan and the Healing Journey staff for warmly welcoming me to this event and asking me to provide some information and inspiration and possibly even some entertainment. We'll see how it goes. I've had the good fortune of deciding who I was and what I was going to do for a long time. I grew up in Washington, D.C., in the shadow of the White House, so I was on Kalorama Road and 16th Street in downtown D.C., and I grew up in a very multicultural neighborhood, so I had the opportunity to play with children from China and Asia and South America and really all around the world, and to experience food and cuisine from different world cultures at an early age. One thing I noticed was that the American cuisine was rather limited and lacking. So at the age of 11, I became Chef Boyardee and used to make these tremendous sandwiches with cousin Chef Boyardee John. And we would pile it high and deep with everything that was in the fridge. And then we would also experiment with the various foods that were in our household. But like most people, at a certain point, I found the American cuisine lacking, and my health was lacking. And as a law school student in 1969, I met a friend from high school who came to Boston where I was staying, and he had a qualitatively different look and feel and energy, similar to Dr. Geffen. And I said, what have you been doing? He said, well, I'm a vegetarian, and I practice yoga. So at that time, I decided to become a vegetarian. So I adopted Rice-A-Roni, the San Francisco treat, and started learning about natural health. Shortly thereafter, I decided to discontinue my studies in law school. I was very committed to social change and political change and world peace. And my family was aghast, in a similar vein to our previous speaker, that I had somehow gone Eastern or different. And I decided to move to the country and move to Western Massachusetts, to the area outside of Amherst, and was able to purchase a 160-acre organic farm 40 years ago for the astoundingly high price of $70,000. Seemed like a lot of money to us at the time. And this farm had 25 acres of arable land that you could stick your arm in the soil all the way to your shoulder. And Al Perkins had been the owner. He had raised 9 children. And none of the 9 children wanted to carry on the farm. They all wanted to go to the city and work at Taco Bell or to do city jobs. So my best friend from high school and associate from college, we decided to buy this property with 3 others. So we had our first commune. And we started to grow food, and it was quite wonderful. And like most people, I had never had that experience of starting food from a seed, from a sprout, and watching it mature and harvesting it, and then cooking it. And we had a wood stove, so this is all very rustic and folkloric, but it was very defining in my life's experience. And our wood stove was called Home Comfort, so I began baking bread on a wood stove, grinding the flour, the whole grain flours, and then sharing it with friends and family. Being a community organizer and a world beater, a farmer was not my true calling. So I began organizing a community food buying club, also known as a co-op. And the beauty of a co-op, and we have a Sacramento co-op that's alive and well, and not as many as I'd like to see, is that we could collaborate on orders. We could buy food at a wholesale price, so I became the buyer of the food club, and at 3 in the morning would drive to Springfield, Massachusetts, and cut into melons and snap peas and green beans and sample the foods and decide this was for us. And by having a food buying club. It brought people together from the traditional factory town of Greenfield, Massachusetts, and some of the newer people like myself who were educated but moving more to natural lifestyles and different ages and cultures there. Out of that, we decided we needed a restaurant. So we had a couple who had worked in a restaurant for 6 months. That seemed like substantial training, substantial. And we were in this can-do mentality back in the 60s for various reasons. I'll leave to your imagination. And we started a restaurant. So we started a natural food restaurant, and we were all vegetarians because that was the way to go. But we realized that we needed some flesh if the local people would come, so we decided to have seafood on the menu. So we had salmon and shrimp scampi and halibut and scallops, which we would just poke at, and if it didn't bleed too much, we decided it was fit to eat. But we cooked all this food from scratch, and then all the while I was studying natural health, and I had the opportunity to meet and study with people like Ann Wigmore, who was at the Hippocrates Health Institute in Boston at the time, and she was a woman who had had cancer and discovered chlorophyll and sprouts as a therapeutic agent. And Michio Kushi was in Boston at the time, so he was actually teaching a different approach, which was macrobiotics, using brown rice and seaweed and miso and an Asian influence. And I had the opportunity to work with Paavo Airola, who was a Finnish naturopath who was in Philadelphia at the time, and he had European influence with sourdough breads and yogurt and kefir and fresh vegetables and herbs and juices. And Dr. Airola had a fasting program that I learned from him in the early 70s and began to use for myself and some of my colleagues and clients. Then on a trip, I went out west and met Dr. Bernard Jensen, who was a West Coast doctor of natural medicine and one who advocated cleansing programs of different sorts and was a very kind and gentle teacher and colleague of mine. So I was picking up pieces of information from different old school teachers and integrating the parts of it that made sense to me into a more eclectic model rather than to fully embrace any one singular position. So out of that time, I then became moved to go to naturopathic school. So I went to a college in Taos, New Mexico. It's always nice to go to a beautiful place to learn. And I studied with a man named William LeSaussier, whose father had been a naturopathic physician and had very strong knowledge of Native American healing traditions and Chinese medicine traditions. So at that point, I was at a crossroads of whether to become a doctor or become an educator. And I looked at the medical profession and I said, it's a tough job to do. We're dealing with people who are not necessarily aware of why they're suffering or why they're ill, and the doctor is expected to fix them. And it doesn't necessarily work to anyone's satisfaction, either the doctor or the patients. So I decided to move in the direction of health education and particularly nutrition education at that point and moved to California, Berkeley, California, and left the farm and left my friends and family back there. They're still there to this day, which is quite wonderful, and started a group called the Berkeley Holistic Health Center in 1976 at the tender age of 30 years old. And at the Berkeley Holistic Health Center, initially we were a group of what was called alternative health practitioners. And I've pretty much retired that term because we're not alternative, we're traditional or we're integrative or we're natural health educators. But at this clinic or this center, we wrote a book called the Holistic Health Handbook in 1978, which was quite popular, sold 250,000 copies in its day, and began doing public speaking and educating, and again, had a crossroads about, did I want to be a conference speaker, or did I want to work in a community and work with clients and students and individuals and maintain a stable marriage. Because it's hard to be a celebrity and have a home life. And again, I opted for working in my community and being an educator and developing a clinic. So in 1978, I invited three medical doctors to join our group, which they did, and invite an acupuncturist to join our group, which he did, and a chiropractor and massage therapist, and we had a free healing circle. So we did quiet prayers for people who were going through difficult changes, and all this was within the circle of a nonprofit, and we had collaborative patient care. That was 30 years ago. Well, unfortunately, my mom got cancer about that time. So all of us here have personal or family issues where someone near and dear to us, including ourselves, was diagnosed with cancer. And I said to her oncologist, I'm a nutritionist, I'm 32 years old. I've read Max Gerson, Natural Cancer Therapy. So Dr. Gerson and his daughter, Charlotte Gerson, is continuing with nutrition work for people with cancer. Had nice documentation that people who have cancer have nutritional deficiencies and that their outcome is improved when they do nutrition as part of their care. And the oncologist, who was 40 years old, I'm in my 60s now, so I look back kind of fondly at things I've done when I was younger or just what it's like to have done a lot of this work. And he said, I appreciate where you're coming from, but it doesn't integrate with our approach. And you know, that was hard to hear. And I explained to my mom, it's her choice of what she does. The doctor is skilled in his work and I'm skilled in my work and we can do these things together. But she was a little slow on picking this up. And with many people, she had a mastectomy, but no further treatment. And then she had a metastasis. And when she had chemo and radiation, it compromised her and she became more fragile and vulnerable. And by the time she started doing some of the things I had suggested, very gently and kindly, it was a little late in the game and she passed. Well, that was something that really gave me the motivation to work with people with cancer and to dig deeper. So I moved to Northern California to a school called Heartwood College in Garberville and started a retreat center and a nutrition training program. So at a retreat center, people could come who had illness or who wanted to educate, learn, grow, be in a different situation. And we did grow a certain amount of our own food. We did have classes. We did have group activities and exercise, and we were outdoors. So it was a fresh, natural environment. And I had several people come up there who went through the stages of healing that Dr. Geffen described. And it's absolutely a stage-based process. And I saw people go through remission, and then when they would come home, their doctors and family were somewhat amazed. I was not remarkably amazed because they did a lot of work on themselves, and their body was given the nourishment and the love and the support to heal, and heal on an emotional level, a physical level, and even on a cellular level. And then to kind of move along with the story, I then decided to get a PhD in health education and completed that and did research on breast cancer and decided to create a college because the work that I had done was to develop a model called Eating for Health. And Eating for Health is a whole food nutrition program, which is somewhat differentiated from the USDA My Pyramid. So the programs that were taught in the universities were the pyramid, and at the time, the original pyramid really was very high in refined carbohydrates and rather low in fresh natural food, and there's still some debate, argument about the value of organic food. But based on my experience being on the farm, growing food, eating food, and kind of using that as the root of the educational system and also the root of the healing system, I had quite a bit of experience seeing its benefits, and then also was able to gather information and research and evidence to support its efficacy. So I've been doing school programs for 20 years at Bowman College. Are we on the screen yet? I'd like to show some slides and would like to give you a lesson in eating for health. There's some notes in your proceedings that you can refer to. Looks like my computer might have gone to sleep. It's taking a nap. But I'll start with some comments about eating for health and see if this shows up. One second. The thing that I find helpful when I'm working with people is to help them, to help them sort out some of the confusion and overwhelm they're in relative to food and diet. Because that's fairly common. In this field, there's lots of differing opinions and differing systems and arguments. And that's not something that empowers people. So with Eating for Health, one way I've helped people to appreciate where they're going in the field of health and nutrition is a system of levels called the four levels of eating. And everyone goes through this at certain times. The first level is eating for pleasure. And we all eat for pleasure. And we eat for pleasure as a way of minimizing pain. So when we're unhappy or we're ill or we're feeling hopeless or helpless, eating is certainly one of the things that we will do to pick ourselves up. But in general, eating for pleasure is not particularly thoughtful. It's mostly ice cream and cookies and cake and dessert. And it can be alcohol as well. So at a second point, people go to level two, which is eating for energy. And people realize that they need energy for blood sugar support. So they'll begin to eat more substantial food. They'll have macronutrients. They'll have proteins. They'll have fats. They'll have carbohydrates. They'll have a turkey sandwich. They'll have a burrito. They'll have a meal that they buy and bring home and eat. So level two is having more calories and more nutrient diversity, but it's not particularly thoughtful or particularly helpful. It's fairly expedient to make sure that they don't run out of gas. Well, we may forego this part of that, the slide thing. What happens to people in the circumstances, sooner or later, whether it's their 20s, their 30s, or their 40s, they begin to not look well. They begin to not feel well. They're not performing at a high level. They develop some kind of an issue or symptom or condition that's not improving. So they may go to a doctor and get some medical advice, or they may come to a nutritionist. And the nutrition will put them on a food plan, which I would call level three, or eating for recovery. So that's good. Most of the healthy diets say minimize refined artificial foods, minimize excessive calories, minimize commercial meats that may have hormones and antibiotics. And on a level three program, and it could be a raw food diet, it could be a macrobiotic diet. I mean, these are legitimate diets. Someone asked me about the Hallelujah diet. That's very well. It's somebody else's idea of what is healthy. And typically after several weeks or months, people plateau on a level three diet. Hey, ho, Good deal. Thank you. Where? All right. I'm back in slide land. All right. I'll finish this level thing. If they're not able to integrate the diet, if they become bored or sick or ill or otherwise, I've had too much celery for the rest of my life, they will go back to level one or level two. Or if they've been on the famous Candida elimination diet, right? People have been on such diets where they're not eating any bread or starches or even sugars. At some point, they'll return to that and overeat, which is unhealthy. Level four is eating for health. So that's the purpose of the system that I've created, is that level four people are being more aware of what's working for them, what's nourishing, what's comfortable, what's healthful, and they're eating enough food to be well-fed, but not too much food to be overfed. And that's one of our greatest struggles here, is getting the right amount of food in the right environment without overeating or undereating. So let's take a look at some of these slides. If we're eating good food, the good food is what's going to nourish our bodies. The healthy food, every cell of our body is going to reflect the quality of the nutrients that's in the food. If we're eating poor foods, it's going to create either lack of nutrient or what I call static in the system. And with the amount of problems in the commercial food system, people are getting quite a bit of static in the system. And I say, how would this relate to an illness such as cancer? Our genes are responding to the information in our environment. Our genes are responding to the information in our food. Our genes are responding to our attitude, and they're surrounding to our state of being. So if we're eating fresh, natural food, our genes will start to express themselves in a healthful way, and they will even alter some of the patterns of illness that may be pre-existing. So that's the great experiment with adding diet to part of a recovery program, is to seeing if it can help the healthy cells to stay healthy, and if it can support the unhealthy cells in slowing their disease progression or going through a process called apoptosis. Raise your hand if you're familiar with that term. So some are, some aren't. But apoptosis is gentle, peaceful, programmed cell death. So that's very interesting. That's a way the body tends to do self-cleaning. Our body can be very efficient in dealing with aberrant cells. And natural, healthy food definitely enhances apoptosis. So our assumptions are that what we eat will affect our quality of life, our longevity factors, our performance, our mood, and our state of being. So what I'd like you to reflect upon today is how you could make those healthy choices and choose the type of foods which we call nutrition heroes. And you have a chart in your notes saying that a nutrition hero is a food that's fresh and natural, and we'll go through some of those items, particularly the colorful fruits and vegetables. Essential nutrition is both the care and feeding of the organism. So I don't think nutrition is only food. It's also the care and the love and the nourishment and the ability to share foods with one another. It's the food and beverages that we eat, it's the air that we breathe, and it's all of the vital factors that support our well-being. Looking at natural versus synthetic, there's not a lot of money to be made in natural foods, and that also explains some of the higher cost of natural organic food. It's much more perishable. So the food industry, which is quite large, has more vested in creating food that has shelf life than food that is fresh and immediate. So it requires a different time management and a different organization on the part of people who are buying fresh and natural food, because they really need to consume it in a couple of days. Think about when you go traveling in a foreign country, what do we love to do? We go to the market. We go shopping. First thing in the morning, we get up, we take a walk, we see some vendors, we have a beverage, we look at the food, we put it in a sack, have a little picnic, go home and eat it. It would be ideal if we could have more of that lifestyle so that people were not just taking food out of the freezer and reheating it. So this is just a reminder that processed foods do not support health, and that they're low in essential nutrients, they're low in fiber, they're low in essential fatty acids, they're low in antioxidants, and they're low in phytonutrients, which are the alkaloids in the plants, which create the message to our nervous system, our hormonal system, and our genes that we're in right relationship with the earth. Having a genetically modified organism in our foods, or altering the way the foods are grown or they're stored or they're prepared, is going to create a different informational message that we haven't completely studied long enough to know whether it's innocuous or whether it's hazardous. But at a point of making the decision to be healthier and to work on one's health, it's the natural foods that will provide the way forward. This is a research study from the JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association. So some people go, well, who do we trust? Who do we believe? The Journal of the American Medical Association is a very well-respected source. And it says that whole foods are the best source of nutrition, rather than dietary supplements. And in the Journal of Clinical Nutrition, it found that vitamin E supplements didn't work as well as vitamin E-rich foods. Having a nutrition clinic and a clinical practice, and dealing with people who have life-threatening illnesses, people who have depression, people who have metabolic issues, children who have learning issues, a wide variety of things, I found that most of the people who come to see me bring in dietary supplements. They're largely good quality. So one could say, well, the supplements are not good quality. They're cheap, they're old, they have fillers, they have binders. But the people who come to see me, by and large, have fairly good quality dietary supplements, but they are somewhat inconsistent in their food pattern. They're somewhat inconsistent in getting fresh, natural food eaten in a relaxed way 3 or 4 times a day. And as we know, if you're not feeling well, even eating becomes a chore. People are constantly saying, you need to eat, you need to eat, you need more food. And you say, well, I have lack of taste or lack poor digestion or just not able to do that. So what we're looking at is how to get nutrients from food and how to get food that's grown in soil that is dynamic and rich and vital. And so supporting local growers will be our way to do that. So some of the foods that have been alleged to promote cancer, and there's not a tremendous body of evidence on this, because who's going to fund the study that says that sugar promotes cancer? Demonstrate to me unequivocally in humans that sugar promotes cancer, because humans eat a good bit of refined sugar, and some people have cancer and some people don't have cancer. So the person who says, well, you know, I eat more sugar than you and I don't have this disease, therefore it's not because of my sugar intake. Cancer is a disease of gene expression. The genes are influenced by the diet, the lifestyle, the environment, and the attitude. So if people have genetic predisposition, even if they eat really good food, they're still dealing with a slightly more challenging situation. So you can see the numbers up here. The average person has several hundred pounds of bad food in a year. And this is something that we're looking to change. We can now measure the amount of body burden of chemicals. 5-10 years ago, this was not possible. There's a group called the Environmental Working Group, EWG.org. which is out of Bilitis, and it's in the same family as Michael Lerner and Commonweal. And these are people who've been back to the land for 30 years. They've been living on the coast. They're not as commercially intoxicated as most people. But yet they had 119 chemicals on average that they've just absorbed from the air and the water and the food supply. So this can now be identified through blood tests and urine tests and stool tests and saliva tests and things of that nature. And some of the chemicals that tend to precipitate and to expedite cancer growth can be identified and neutralized through natural means. So here's the Eating for Health model. It's a pretty picture. It's a mandala. It's a bullseye. It's a chart. It's a plate. And I want you to notice at the very center of this picture are seeds and oils. Seeds are the life force of a plant. So eating high quality seeds not only supports life function, it also provides an excellent source of amino acids, of fatty acids, of fibers, of minerals. Seeds are the highest source of magnesium and zinc in the plant family. They're the highest source of B vitamins in the plant family. So someone could say, well, I thought leafy greens were the best source of B vitamins. Weight to weight, leafy greens have so much water, they're not as concentrated as a sunflower seed or a pumpkin seed or a flax seed. The standard American diet, which I don't know if people eat the standard American diet anymore, but it's generally meat and potatoes, or it's generally refined foods or burgers and fries or whatnot, it's very acid forming. And by acid forming, it means it leaves a residue in the body of nitrogen, sulfur, and phosphorus. And you go, well, that's not so bad. Those are minerals. They're elements in the earth. We need these elements for energy. But it tends to be depleting by having a predominance of acid forming minerals and also acid waste, which is the more problematic from sugar metabolism. And cancer is an obligate sugar feeder. So certain cells, certain fast-growing cells, they have a higher demand for fuel, and the fuel they prefer is sugar, particularly refined sugar that is lacking in cofactors like potassium, vitamin C, B vitamins, and things of that nature. So when people eat fresh fruits, which also have a very high carbohydrate content, high sugar content, high fruit sugar content, they don't tend to be cancer promoters because of the nutrients and the phytonutrients in the skins and in the seeds and in the pulp. And fruits are very high in bioflavonoids. And bioflavonoids are a category of nutrients that support detoxification, that support capillary and vascular integrity, that support stability within the metabolic system. Bioflavonoids are in all fresh fruits and vegetables, but they're lost when these fresh fruits and vegetables are processed. So that's why we're looking at, one could eat fresh fruits and fresh veg with skins and pulp and seeds and so forth, and even though they have a certain amount of sugar, the sugar is protective, it's not promoting. An eating for health approach would provide 150% of the recommended dietary allowance for nutrients. So it's looking at a more optimal standard rather than a minimum standard or a maintenance standard. And it's not particularly hard to do. You can look at your nutrition heroes and bandits chart. You can circle where you are on the friendly foods, and you want to move to the right. So it would be never and seldom and sometimes and frequently. And the more frequently you are on your nutritional heroes foods, which are each of the different categories of eating for health, you go, well, I need to eat more fruits and veg, or I need to eat more nuts and seeds, or I need to have more natural beverages. And then on the nutrition bandit side, which would be refined sugars and artificial sugars and damaged fats and commercial meat, you also want to move to less consumption. But on that chart, it would still be moving to a healthy side. So people can use that as a scorecard in a direction of what to accentuate and what to diminish. We're looking at both the quality and the quantity of foods. So with an eating for health approach, that level four approach, people would be eating a little bit less, but by eating a little bit less, they have a higher efficiency of digestion. So think about that. Suppose you need nourishment and you need calories and you need energy and you want to heal your body. Would you have a higher success by eating more with a compromised digestion or eating less, which would create less burden on your digestive system? The process of eating is something that shifts the neurohormonal balance towards the parasympathetic nervous system. So that's very interesting. The sympathetic nervous system is stress-driven. It's fight or flight. The parasympathetic nervous system is restorative. It's restful. It's digestive. Chewing is the act that enables the body to get out of the brain and the thinking, acting, doing mode into the body, which is the being and healing mode. So it's kind of interesting. So eating a little less and eating it more slowly and chewing it more efficiently and being in a positive state of eating, you're not overloaded by rushing through one's meal. So it's an alternative to the pyramid, which is moving more in a natural, healthful exercise activity as well as foods direction. So there are various characteristics of eating for health, whole food, organic food that are pesticide free. And one could argue pesticides, how dangerous are they? Well, if you're not well, you don't want any foreign compounds to get into your body because they create a challenge to the immune system. And my observation of working with people with cancer is, in addition to having an immune system that's a little underwhelmed, it's a little tired, they're also running into challenges with their liver. It's kind of interesting that the liver is the gateway to the immune system. The liver is what filters the blood. The liver is what denatures foreign chemicals or hormones that drive cancer. So by having a more plant-based diet, plenty of lemon and chlorophyll, plenty of spices like turmeric and ginger and coriander, having the booster foods in this model. So the signature of eating for health is that ring. I don't know if you can see it up there. It's a little muted. There are four different booster foods. One is herbs and spices. And from a nutritional point of view, look at how you can add herbs and spices to every meal, even to your beverages. Think about what you can have with your breakfast food. Suppose you like oatmeal in the morning. Oatmeal is a nice whole grain. It's got fiber. It's got B vitamins. It's got some magnesium, potassium. It's got a moderate amount of protein. You can add cinnamon to that. You can add nutmeg to that. You can add cardamom. Try adding cardamom to your cereals or your beverages. Cardamom is particularly good for nausea. It's particularly good for lack of appetite. Either adding cardamom to the food or putting just a few cardamom seeds in one mouth, it stimulates digestion and appetite. Clearly, the food of the last year or two is turmeric. And turmeric is sort of a carrot and a ginger that got married. And what you see is a root, little finger-like root, that's orange or yellow. Fresh turmeric is very pleasant. You can put it in tea. You can put it in soup. You can use it as you would use ginger. And turmeric has its action potentiated when it's mixed with lemon. So again, it's using a curry spice and putting in a little bit of lemon is a way of getting these herbs and spices into your food, which enliven the food, create a digestive improvement, and also create some signaling within the genetic system that all is well. So apparently in our limbic brain, we're fairly closely connected to the earth. And when the foods that we eat are far away from the earth, far away from nature, far away from ethnicity and culture that we might have come from, we begin to get a little bit disturbed or out of balance, or we lose a certain amount of vitality. A couple of other booster foods to mention are sea vegetables. How many people here eat sea vegetables on a regular basis? Hardly any. We have some Asians. Well, there's a couple over there. Go you. All right? What I'd encourage you to really grow into is the delights of seaweed. Get some nori, which is wrapping paper. Wrap your CDs or DVDs in nori and give them to people and say, here, eat this paper. All right? You can do that. You know, you can do that. Nori is a very pleasant purple food. It's sort of a composite of seaweed. And you can use it as a wrap just as you'd use a burrito or a sandwich or sushi. And it can be traditional Oriental or it can be Tex-Mex, for all I care. All right? But it's very nice food. It's very mineral rich. It's very salty, but not excessively salty. And it has a higher potassium than sodium content for people who are worried about that. Another food or food compound, what I call a dietary supplement, would be the algaes, things such as spirulina and chlorella. And I put together a food foundational powder because I would say to people, you need 16 different foods, and the recommendation now is for 9 fruits and vegetables a day. And most people have that 2 or 3 is it's a lot of fruit and veg for them. So by getting high quality organic foods and dehydrating them and putting them in a food powder, they can go into a blended drink, or they can go into an oatmeal, or they can go into applesauce, or they can go into yogurt. And they provide very digestible, very mild, neutral tasting food that's particularly good when somebody is going through a healing challenge or they're not feeling well and they need nutrients, but they can't really eat a big plate of food. So adding some of these powders and spices would be very helpful. I want to suggest that we look at having seeds as primary food, right? Cheese is most people's primary food. People are very fond of dairy food. It's traditional food. It's Northern European food. It's comfort food. It's actually quite relaxing and quite enjoyable. But looking at seeds or nuts and seeds as an alternative or a complement to dairy food. So rather than getting in an either-or mentality, you could say, well, I'll have some fresh organic yogurt, and I'll also have a nut spread or a nut milk. It can be very nourishing, and it gives the body a different set of nutrients. In general, nuts are particularly high in magnesium, and magnesium is the nutrient that people need to relax. Magnesium is the mineral that keys people into their relaxation response. So I'm going to end this part of the conversation with saying, think about improving your diet by adding both nuts and seeds, adding organic fruits and vegetables, adding some spices to your diet, and don't think so much about your illness or think so much about the past, but think about a future or think about the present when you're surrounded yourself with beautiful foods and beautiful friends and nice music and appreciation and love, And remember to say grace after you eat the meal, as well as before the meal. And if you can, you could say grace while you're chewing. Think about that. Because it's a graceful moment to be able to appreciate nice food and nice friends and know that we're taking care of ourselves. What I say to every person I meet with is your chances are good of recovery. And they go, what? I have a very serious illness, doctor. You really don't understand. And I go, it depends on how you define recovery. If recovery is increasing your vitality, increasing your thoughts, your feelings, your relations, your appreciation, that's a recovery. And if you're here today, the chances of you being here tomorrow are also pretty good, because what you eat today will profoundly influence the way you look, you act, you think, and how you behave tomorrow. So thank you for your time.
I asked Dr. Bellman to stay here with me just for a minute because the implication of his talk and Dr. Geffen's was that we should all be vegetarians, and I want to say that I personally was a vegetarian for 12 years and continued to have cancer recurrences. And then I learned that for my particular metabolic type, I needed to eat some meat, and it needed to be whole foods meat. It needed to not be processed meat. But I wanted him to stay here so he could say, yes, that's true.
I will validate that.
Okay.
And I will even give an example. Stories are good. The little couple comes to see me, and the guy is in his 70s, and he's really thin. I mean, he's way too thin. He's kind of been wasting. He has cachexia, and he's got a colon issue. And his wife, you know, she's big. And so she says, raw food's for you, Buster. And I go, well, how's your blood? He goes, oh, my blood is very weak. You know, I have low hematocrit, I have low hemoglobin, I have low iron. I go, well, you would really benefit from eating red meat. You would really benefit from eating liver and lamb. And if you want to be raw food, you can juice it, because that's what Dr. Max Gerson did in his day. Or if not, you get the cleanest source, because if the meat eats grass and the grass is not filled with pesticides or herbicides, the meat is actually a fantastic source of nutrient. And if you mix that with a serving or three of vegetables, you'll be a healthier and happier person. And he just shined and said, thank you, I really needed to hear that. So avoidance of bad quality anything is necessary, but there is a myth that people can, quote, cure cancer by having either a low-protein diet or a plant-based only diet, and that really hasn't been the case, because we all do have our different needs and backgrounds and metabolic tendencies.
Thank you very much. Yes.